This is the Library Channel. Welcome to the Simon Ortiz and Labriola Center Lecture on Indigenous Land, Culture, and Community. Presenting Tribal Land Claims, a Generation of Federal Indian Law on the Edge, sponsored by the ASU American Indian Studies Program, Department of English, American Indian Policy Institute, the Labriola National American Indian Data Center, Faculty of History in the School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies, Women and Gender Studies in the School of Social Transformation, the Indian Legal Program in the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law, and the Heard Museum. Locklear demonstrates how attorneys for tribes have used the doctrine of discovery or federal common law to assert claims in tribal land claim cases. She lays out the history of the Oneida land claim case against the state of New York beginning in 1784, when the state began an aggressive campaign to acquire Oneida territory leading to their currently pending case. Simon Ortiz opens the program.
Thank you very much for welcoming us here, you know, to the Heard. And thank you to all of you, of course, for being here. This series, the Indigenous Speakers series, which offers the Simon Ortiz and Labriola Center lecture on Indigenous land, culture, and community, is in its fourth year. And we're very proud and glad to continue, because the people in the community of Phoenix include, of course, indigenous peoples as well as non-indigenous peoples. And we all need one another as people, as members of the city of Phoenix, and obviously of our own local communities. And it's important that we are able to recognize, you know, who we are as Hano, Hano in the Acoma language, of which I am a member. Ako meshtata means people. Hano sai haupa Hano sata. All of us are people, you know, who are relatives, actually. So I appreciate all of you coming. And also, I want to make sure that I thank our sponsors. Essentially, the speaker series is sponsored by the ASU American Indian Policy Institute, American Indian Studies Program, Department of English, Faculty of History in the School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies, Indian Legal Program in the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law, and of course, Labriola Center, and the Heard Museum, which is a partner to us with the units from ASU. And of course, tonight I'm introducing our speaker, Arlinda Locklear, who is a member of the Lumbee Hano, or people, or tribe from North Carolina. I've been there and as a very welcomed visitor a number of times. First in 1970, and the last time was maybe 3 years ago, but several times. I've conducted writing workshops and taught a course one summer during June, I think it was, in part of July, at the Pembroke State University, which is now a university in North Carolina at Pembroke University now. Arlinda Locklear has a particularly distinguished career in federal Indian law. During her 35 years of experience in this field, Locklear has represented tribes throughout the U.S. in federal and state courts on treaty claims to water and land taxation, disputes with states and local authorities, reservation boundary issues, and federal recognition of tribes. In particular, she is a nationally recognized expert in federal recognition of tribes and Indian land claims. Locklear began her career as an attorney at the Native American Rights Fund in Boulder, Colorado, and later transferred to Washington, D.C., to the Washington, D.C. office. As directing attorney for 7 years in the Washington, D.C. office, Locklear supervised significant litigation of Indian issues as well as the legislative work of the office. Locklear was a member of the board of advisors for the Encyclopedia of Native Americans in the 20th century and is a member of the board of trustees for the University of North Carolina, Pembroke. Locklear was awarded the Outstanding Woman of Color Award given by the National Institute of Women of Color in 1987, the Julian T. Pierce Award given by Pembroke State University in 1994, the 1995 Carpathian Award for Speaking Out given by the North Carolina Equity, the Parks Award for Community Service given by the North Carolina State University in 2003, the 2008 Kate Stoneman Award for Outstanding Achievement in the Legal Profession given by the Albany Law School, and the 2009 Distinguished Alumna Award from the College of Charleston. Locklear earned her law degree from Duke University School of Law and is a member of the bars of Maryland, North Carolina, and the District of Columbia. She also holds honorary doctorates from State University of New York, Oneonta, and North Carolina State University. That's formally in recognition of her. And less formally, I will say that of all the trips that I took to North Carolina and visited her her community and her tribal people, we never met until today. And I think that I know that I'm glad that she's here because like other tribal indigenous people, you know, I've found her to be very helpful. Ekoshe eme yu kaika sha papa atitra e nanatitra. Totra eme tiwantipo. Taisi yu kutsi tawan ni wotra skua, juma haupa. Because we need one another according to the grandmothers and grandfathers so that we may continue in our lives in a positive way. We do need help. And Arlinda Locklear, in her profession as a lawyer, is one of those important people of the members of our society and culture in the U.S. And so with those words, I want us to welcome Arlinda Locklear.
Thank you for those kind words. Thank you for your welcome. The hospitality at ASU has been just wonderful today. It's been a great day, and I've enjoyed spending time with you. And I look forward to this opportunity to speak with you about one of my favorite subjects. We are at a crossroads on a land issue that it's of fundamental importance to Native communities across the United States. I want to talk to you about that a little bit tonight to tell you where we are, how we got where we are, and what our hopes are about the future. Let me begin by saying, the doctrine of discovery, original title, exclusive power of the United States. These are all familiar, one might say, founding concepts of federal Indian law. They are familiar because they've been with us since the early 18th century, trace their doctrinal source back to the early 17th century. And they are founding concepts because so many other basic concepts of federal Indian law are based upon them. For example, the reserved rights construction of federal Indian treaties, the inapplicability of state property law concepts to tribal property rights, and the continuing vitality of tribal property rights despite the passage of time. But we need to examine the basic concept to understand what it means and how it has been useful or not in the protection of tribal land rights. The doctrine of discovery is really a legal fiction. Chief Justice Marshall admitted as much when he first articulated it in 1823 in the Supreme Court. I like to think of it as a sword, the sword that is held by the conqueror, because according to the Chief Justice, that's what we are. We are all conquered people. And based upon that legal fiction that somehow by arrival upon the soils of this new country, we became, by operation of law, conquered people. That sword has two sides. On the one side of that sword is the fundamental basis of the power that the United States asserts against Native people. That power says, you may be in occupation of this land, but your continuing rights to it, your continuing powers of self-government, are subject to the defeasance of the United States. We hold ultimate dominion over your territory. That's the destructive side of the sword. On the other side is a protective edge of the conqueror's sword. The protective edge says to the native communities, we may be able to take your land, but no one else can take your land. We will protect you in the continued possession of your land, and we will create a monopoly of that power so that no other entity, states, foreign governments, third parties, no other entity can exercise the same power that we may exercise over your land to take it from you. That's the sword that the doctrine of discovery represents. And that's the sword that we have looked to in a body of cases called, that we refer to as the tribal land claim cases on the protective side to give us a basis to assert continued possession of tribal lands as against third parties. In the classic sense, the tribal land claim cases refer to a body of cases in which tribes assert the right to continued possession of their lands in the face of efforts by third parties, usually states, to deprive them of the continued possession of their lands. And what gives you the right and the power in the native communities to rely upon that protective edge is the circumstance where those attempts to dispossess take place without the consent or the approval of the United States. That's the key factor that allows tribes to assert, under that protective side of the doctrine of discovery, the continued right to possession of their territory, so long as the United States did not consent or approve of an attempted taking of tribal lands by either a state or a third party. We have a claim to recover possession of those lands. Those are the tribal land claim cases in the classic sense. A whole generation of federal Indian law has taken place over the last 20 years in the successful assertion of those cases in federal court. We have experienced remarkable success in those cases. We are at a crossroads, though, where we may discover very soon whether the protective edge of the sword has fallen away so that all we are left with is the destructive side of the doctrine of discovery. I want to recount for you how we got to that place. And the mechanism for doing that is to explain to you the Oneida land claim case. The Oneida land claim case was the first of many, and the precedent that was established in the Oneida land claim case spawned other cases. So let me begin by a brief overview of what the Oneida land claim case is. First, let me summarize very briefly for you the facts, the history that give rise to the Oneida land claim case. And remember that this is typical of the circumstances that appear in all of these cases. At the time of white contact, the Oneida Nation was in occupation of approximately 6 million acres of land right in the middle of New York State. As the middle member of the Six Nations Confederacy, they had members to their right and members to their left, and among them all, between the Six Nations Confederacy, they virtually occupied the entire area of New York State as we know it today. The extent, and in fact, the claim to title that the Oneida Nation asserted to that 6 million acres was well known at the time. As early as 1784, the Oneida leadership was asked by Governor Clinton of New York State at the time to explain to us the boundaries of your territory, admitting that Oneida title existed. Oneida leadership was able to do so. Oneida leadership responded with a very precise meets and bounds description, remarkably like we would give in the early common law, of their territory, following natural courses of rivers, stones, mountains. Also in 1784, the United States concluded the Treaty of Fort Stanwix with members of the Six Nations Confederacy, including the Oneida. The purpose of the Treaty of Fort Stanwix was to conclude hostilities following the conclusion of the Revolutionary War. Members of the Confederacy had fought on both sides as allies of the United States and allies of Great Britain. The Oneida had fought as allies of the United States. And as a result of that alliance, the Oneidas were given special protection in the Treaty of Fort Stanwix. Article 2 of that treaty secured the Oneidas in the continued possession of their land. So we have not only the protective side of the doctrine of discovery, but we also have overlaid with that is the special treaty protection in the 1784 treaty. Despite this protection, though, New York State embarked upon an aggressive land acquisition policy as against not only the Oneidas, but all members of the Six Nations Confederacy. And it's important to point out what the fundamental basis of that policy was. State negotiators were specifically instructed by the state legislature at the time to do two things: to undertake acquisition of Oneida territory in such a way as to excite as little concern among the Oneidas as possible. They didn't want the Indians to become upset. Secondly, they were specifically instructed to pay the Oneidas no more than 1/4 the known value of the land at the time. In other words, the transactions were to be duplicitous and they were to be grossly underpaid as well. That was stated state policy in 1784. And despite the protections of the 1784 treaty and the protective side of the doctrine of discovery, New York State acted quickly on its policy. In 1785 and 1788, New York State concluded two treaties, which they called treaties, with the Oneida Nation, by which New York State acquired virtually all of the Oneida territory, save for approximately 300,000 acres that was set aside as a reservation for the Oneida people. In later federal treaties, 1789 and 1794, this same Oneida reservation was again guaranteed by the United States to the Oneida people. The 1784 security for the protection of their lands was repeated twice in those treaties. In addition, the protective side of the doctrine of discovery was enacted by Congress, codified in statute in 1790 in what we call the Non-Intercourse Act. The Non-Intercourse Act basically stated in statute what the protective provision of the doctrine of discovery provided: that no transfer of tribal land shall be of any validity under law unless undertaken with the approval or consent of the United States. So by 1790, we have federal common law, as the doctrine of discovery has been called. We have federal treaty protections specifically for Oneida Territory. And we have an act of Congress that codifies all of this into a specific statute, providing the tribes, all tribes, the continued possession of their lands. But state policy did not change. Despite these federal treaty and statutory protections, the state of New York continued with its aggressive land acquisition policy. Between 1795 and 1846, the state of New York negotiated a series of 26 transactions by which they acquired virtually every acre of the reserved 300,000-acre Oneida Reservation. And the practice of the means of concluding these transactions continued as they had been in 1785 and 1788. They were conducted through coercion, duplicity, and again, the Oneidas were grossly underpaid. All of these transactions were concluded, save one, without the consent or approval of the United States. That is the fundamental basis of what we call the land claim. That because of the violation not only of federal treaty, the protective provision of the Doctrine of Discovery, and the Non-Intercourse Act, the Oneidas held, theoretically, under those doctrines, a claim to recovery of their land for violation of all of those federal doctrines. Let me emphasize a few key facts before we begin to discuss the actual lawsuits themselves and how they have progressed through courts. I think it's important to understand this. First, these transactions were not arm's length bargains at which the Oneidas bargained on an equal basis with the state of New York and achieved a fair exchange. Not at all. Every single transaction was the result of fraud or deceit. Secondly, in every transaction, as I noted before, the Oneidas were grossly underpaid. And thirdly, they were undertaken by the state of New York in knowing violation of federal law. Before the 1790 transaction that we'll talk about in a few moments, the federal Indian agent at the time became aware of New York State's aggressive land acquisition policy with respect to the Six Nations Confederacies. He took the step of inquiring about from the Attorney General, the United States Attorney General at the time, William Bradford, as to the legality of this plan under the Non-Intercourse Act. Attorney General Bradford put his opinion in writing that were the state of New York to undertake this plan without the approval or consent of the United States, the transactions would violate the Non-Intercourse Act, federal treaties, and federal common law. And the consequences would be that Oneida title had not been validly extinguished. So all of these transactions took place with knowledge by New York State that they were in violation of federal law. They took place nonetheless. Finally, there's one other key fact that we need to keep in mind. These transactions did not take place without complaint by the Oneida people themselves. They knew they had been promised aid by the United States. They knew that aid had not been forthcoming. And as early as 1790, by the time of the third transaction, we were hearing a continuous series of complaints from the Oneida leaders themselves. One is particularly poignant and poetic, and it gives an example of what the Oneida people were experiencing at the time. There was an Oneida leader in 1790 by the name of Good Peter. Good Peter had been a leader of the Oneidas at the time of the 1785 and 1788 state transactions. He was also aware of the state plans after the Non-Intercourse Act to continue to acquire Oneida territory. Good Peter went to Timothy Pickering, who was the federal Indian agent at the time in upstate New York, and complained, recounting a dream that he had had to Timothy Pickering. Good Peter told the federal Indian agent that after his last transaction with New York State, at which he thought he had actually protected Oneida territory, only to discover later that indeed he had lost it, he began to have dreams. And in these dreams, birds came to him. And the birds cried out, "You have lost your country. You have lost your country." And what alarmed good Peter the most, he recounted to Timothy Pickering, was that the birds were white. That began a series of complaints. Every single Oneida leader from that time forward complained repeatedly, not only to the federal government, but also to the governor of New York. There was a special relationship there that they thought. But in every instance, there was no aid forthcoming. So that by the time these transactions were completed, the Oneida people, who had been favored as an original ally of the United States as early as 1784, were reduced to homelessness and abject poverty. By that point in their history, they had no alternative except to leave their homeland, to leave their territory. It was overrun by non-Indians at the encouragement of New York State, and most of them relocated to other territories where they could take refuge. Because their complaints produced nothing, the Oneidas, several generations later, and out of great frustration, decided to take their case to the federal courts. In 1970, the first lawsuit was filed. This was a lawsuit in which the Oneidas challenged the first of that series of transactions after the adoption of the Non-Intercourse Act in 1790. It was a transaction included in 1795. It's often referred to in the case law as the Oneida test case. The reason it bears that name is because the Oneidas thought, we'll take the first and we'll establish in court the federal principle that the doctrine of discovery, the federal treaties, and the Non-Intercourse Act have meaning in law, and that the violation of those, which clearly took place at the hands of New York State, give us a right in federal court to sue for possession of our land. But they did so in a very narrow way. They did not seek ejectment. They did not seek to evict anyone from their territory. They sought only trespass damages for the 2 years preceding the filing of the lawsuit, and they sued only the two counties who were in possession of the land at the time, Madison and Oneida counties. So in that sense, it was a very narrow lawsuit, but the purpose of the lawsuit was to establish the legal principle that there was real meaning behind the protective side of the doctrine of discovery and the other federal treaty and statutory provisions. At the time, we didn't know what the reaction in federal court would be. It was unclear under federal law whether the federal courts even had jurisdiction to entertain such a suit. It was unclear at the time whether these federal provisions of common law, statute, and treaty could support an action to recover possession of land. So the Oneidas were on the vanguard. They were asserting a theory that was supported by the law in principle. But the question was whether the federal court would take that principle and give it force and allow the Oneidas to proceed on their claim. Initially, the federal court response was no, they could not. For complicated jurisdictional reasons, the federal courts ruled that these claims, because they sounded like a regular claim for trespass that is based on state law, these claims were based on state law, and federal courts, which are limited to federal claims, lacked jurisdiction to assert them. So the claims were dismissed, both by the district court and the Court of Appeals. However, the Supreme Court in 1973 agreed to review the case. And in a remarkable decision, the Supreme Court ruled in 1974 that the Oneidas were correct on their fundamental theory, that the federal courts did indeed have jurisdiction to entertain the claim, and that the claims were entitled to go forward. The cases were remanded to the district court for further proceedings. At that point, another remarkable event occurred. There was a very courageous federal district court judge named Edmund Port, who is no longer with us, who, when he, after trial in the Oneida land claim case, looked at the federal law and said, "I understand these words. These words mean exactly what they purport to say." And he entered judgment for the Oneidas on the principle that Oneida title had not been extinguished, that the doctrine of discovery, the protective side, the Non-Intercourse Act, the federal treaties had real meaning, and that transactions that lacked the necessary consent or approval of the United States were void, as if they had never occurred. As a result, Judge Port awarded the 2 years trespass damages that the Oneidas had sought in that limited case. The money judgment was small, but the principle was huge, and the case had implications that caught a lot of judges and residents in the area's attention. For the first time, people began to understand that these fundamental principles of federal Indian law that we had talked about had real meaning and impact on the ground. There were a number of defenses that the counties in the case asserted. They were legal defenses. They did not dispute the facts. There was no question that the Oneida had been in occupation. There was no question it was Oneida territory. There was no question that the transactions took place without federal approval or consent. There was no question that New York State knew that federal law required that consent. Instead, they asserted a number of technical defenses to say to the court, this cannot really be what federal law requires. They asserted a number of defenses under state law, such as the state statute of limitations. That's not uncommon. Sometimes federal courts will adopt a state statute of limitations and apply it even to a federal law claim where there is no federal statute of limitations. Judge Port rejected that defense. Judge Port decided that federal law in this case was enacted in contemplation of the fact that these claims would not be governed by state law, and he would not allow state law to cut off the Oneida rights. That claim was rejected. The counties also argued a defense that's called latches under the law. Latches is just a Latin phrase that represents a defense in the law that says, if you rest on your rights too long, and so too much time passes between the original wrongdoing and the action in court, you may be considered to have barred your claim because of the passage of time. That defense was asserted by the counties as well. Judge Port rejected that defense. Judge Port again decided that the protective provisions of federal statutory and treaty law defined the only means by which Oneida title could be extinguished, and that was by an act of Congress. Absent that act of Congress, no other doctrine of law, state statute of limitations or latches, could be applied to limit the claim. Finally, the counties asserted a series of defenses that can best be described as the claim is simply too large to contemplate and we cannot allow this to go forward. They argued to Judge Port that you cannot undermine a system of property title rights that have been relied upon for 150 years by the non-Indians who now occupy that area and say to them, which the implication was clear, you are trespassing on Oneida territory. Judge Port rejected those defenses as well. So all defenses were rejected, judgment was entered in favor of the Oneidas, and the appeals began. When the case reached the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, they also did a remarkable thing. The Court of Appeals affirmed that judgment in all respects, and they specifically indicated that there is no principle of law that says because the wrong that was originally done was large and has implications, that there is no remedy for it. There is no principle in the law that says that. Finding no such principle, they affirmed Judge Port's ruling. The Supreme Court decided to review again. At that point, having prevailed in the lower courts, we were worried what the result would be. Typically, the Supreme Court, if they're satisfied with the law as found by the Court of Appeals below, will not review a case. But in this case, the Supreme Court decided it was an important case, and they did review it again. In another remarkable development, in 1985, the Supreme Court affirmed both the District Court and the Court of Appeals ruling. The Supreme Court decided that those fundamental federal common law principles that are reflected on the protective side of the doctrine of discovery give rise to an actual claim by the Oneidas to recover their land. They also rejected the same defenses that had been asserted in the Court of Appeals. They determined that the state statute of limitations could not be applied to cut off Oneida rights. They also specifically determined that the implications of the case, the suggestion that there may be others who are trespassing on Oneida land, are insufficient to cut off Oneida rights. However, they reserved on the question of latches. That is, they issued no opinion on that because in the meantime, the counties had abandoned that defense. For strategic reasons, the counties decided that was not the right time or the context to assert that defense. So the Supreme Court did not reach, even though there were four dissenters in the case who urged them to do so, the majority did not reach the latches defense. That was to have consequences, as we'll see in the future. The Supreme Court did say, though, in its final passage in the Oneida decision in 1985, that this is indeed a remarkable case. And it may be that at some point in the future, if the litigation continues, that it may be necessary to impose equity limitations, limitations based on fundamental ideas of fairness, as to the relief that the Oneidas may get ultimately at the end of the day, but that the claim is valid and they affirmed the judgment in favor of the Oneidas. At that point, the Oneidas, at the request of New York State, agreed to take a stay in the litigation. We agreed to a timeout to attempt an out-of-court settlement in the Oneida land claim case. Those efforts continued between New York State and the Oneidas for nearly 10 years. There were court-ordered mediations, there were informal negotiations, but at the end of the day, all of those efforts failed. But in the meantime, other developments were taking place that would eventually prove to be very troublesome for the Oneida claim as well. One of those involved other tribal claims which had been filed after the 74 decision in Oneida and based on the Oneida precedent to challenge a similar history that the other six nations had experienced at the hands of New York State. Remember, New York State's aggressive land acquisition policy applied to all tribes there. And once the federal courthouse door was open, those tribes began to assert their claims as well. One of those was the Cayuga Nation. The Cayuga Nation pursued its claim during that 10-year period that the Oneida were in negotiations. And they, like the Oneidas, experienced remarkable success. Unlike the Oneidas, though, the Cayugas had asserted the full measure of relief in their claim. The Cayuga claim consists of approximately 64,000 acres in upstate New York, and the Cayugas took very seriously the implications of the Oneida decisions. In their lawsuit, they demanded the recovery of possession of all 64,000 acres, and they sought trespass damages not for the prior 2 or 10 years, but for the entire period of dispossession. In a proceeding on the relief in that case, another federal district court judge decided that it was time to bring reality, as he called it, to the business of formulating relief in these claims. And after a trial on the appropriate form of damages, Judge McKern entered a judgment in the Cayuga case, which basically transformed the land claim cases from claims to recovery of possession of land to claims for possession of money damages against the original wrongdoer only, that is the state of New York. In Judge McKern's mind, equity required that there be repose for those private individuals who were now in occupation of that territory, and that a substitute remedy be given in the form of money damages only and only against New York State. In the meantime, a second event was taking place that would have an impact on the Oneida land claim. During the period of time that the Oneidas were attempting to settle the claim, One of the tribal plaintiffs, the Oneida Nation of New York, had been actively purchasing land in the Oneida Claim Area. The nation took the position once it purchased that land, that upon purchase, that land reverted back to its original reservation status, as such was subject to the governance of the Oneida Nation of New York, and as such was non-taxable by the counties. The counties disagreed, continued to tax the land, and the Oneidas went to federal court to seek an injunction against the imposition of those taxes. The Oneida Nation of New York originally prevailed in both the district court and the Court of Appeals, with those courts holding that indeed, upon acquisition by the Oneidas, that land became Indian territory, subject to the protection of the original federal common law and treaty protections that we discussed before, and non-taxable by the counties. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court granted review in that case as well. In a case called Oneida Nation versus City of Sherrill versus Oneida Nation, I'm sorry, by that time the parties had reversed, the court reached the question of whether that particular form of relief was available to the Oneidas as a part of the overall relief for the Oneida land claim. In an 8-1 decision, the Oneida Nation of New York lost. The Supreme Court held in the City of Sherrill opinion that this particular form of relief was not available to the Oneidas. It's interesting, though, Justice O'Connor, who had been a member of the majority in the 1985 decision, also was a member of the majority in the City of Sherrill decision. It was clear she saw no inconsistency. In addition, the City of Sherrill court, in their opinion, was very careful to say, because this is a different form of relief that the Oneidas are seeking, we need not disturb our decision in the 1985 Oneida decision, where we affirmed an award of trespass damages as an appropriate relief. Finally, the City of Sherrill opinion also noted with approval the decision that had been rendered by the district court in the Cayuga case, where the judge was very careful to weigh equities and to substitute a money damages award instead of a possessory award for the Cayuga claim. All of those factors together convinced us that the Oneida land claim, at least as a money damages award, had survived the City of Sherrill decision. In the meantime, though, the Oneidas, having failed in their efforts to settle, had gone back to court. At that point, sort of an ironic twist in the case, the United States accompanied the Oneidas. Finally, the aid that the Oneidas had sought for generations came in the form of the United States as co-plaintiff, standing shoulder to shoulder with the Oneidas to say the Oneidas are entitled to relief for the violation of their possessory rights by the state of New York. Unfortunately, though, the combination of the timing between the City of Sherrill decision and Cayuga was to prove a turning point in the tide on the land claim cases. At the time that the City of Sherrill decision was rendered, the Cayuga case was pending before the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. It had been thoroughly briefed and argued. When the City of Sherrill decision was announced, the Second Circuit asked the parties to submit additional briefs to address the impact of the City of Sherrill decision on the Cayuga case. The tide had indeed turned at that point. The Second Circuit announced a decision that really stunned the tribal plaintiffs and I think the United States, who had enjoyed 20 years, a whole generation of federal Indian law success in these cases. And the Second Circuit ruled that now was the time to apply the defense of laches and to bar the Cayuga claim, not only the possessory claim, but also even a money damages claim, bar all forms of a relief for the Cayuga. It squared its decision in Cayuga with the 1985 Oneida decision by pointing out that the Oneida court in 1985 had reserved on the question of laches, had not reached it. But in the view of the Court of Appeals, the City of Sherrill decision gave them the right to reconsider the application of latches and to then apply it to the Cayuga case so that all forms of remedy were barred. At that point, New York State realized that it had a defense that could protect it against all the land claims. At that point, New York State immediately proceeded against all of the tribal plaintiffs based on the Cayuga precedent to have them all dismissed. At that point, we began to see the rapid disintegration of the tribal land claim cases as we had known them for 20 years. In the motion to dismiss the Oneida land claim based on the Cayuga precedent, the district court judge in the Oneida case found a difference between the Oneida case and the Cayuga decision from the Court of Appeals. The district court held that there were some differences that would justify allowing the money damages claim for the Oneidas to proceed. The judge held that the Oneidas, unlike the Cayugas, had asserted a claim for fair compensation of their land. Remember that the history in Oneida had documented that they had been grossly underpaid for the original violations. The judge held that that was not the disruptive form of relief that the Court of Appeals had relied upon so heavily in the Cayuga decision. So that survived the Cayuga ruling. On appeal to the Second Circuit, though, the Court of Appeals disagreed. The Court of Appeals reached the same conclusion in Oneida that it had reached in Cayuga, that the form of relief was so disruptive, whether it be money damages or not, that no relief could be tolerated for the land claim cases. It directed the dismissal of the Oneida land claim on the same basis that it had the Cayuga land claim. The court in the Cayuga Court of Appeals decision had said that the City of Sherrill decision marked a dramatic change, alteration in the law of the land claim cases as we had known it. That was not the case. The alteration occurred at the level of the Court of Appeals, not at the level of the Supreme Court. This is evident in a simple comparison between the Court of Appeals decision in 1983 in the Oneida case and their subsequent decision in 2010. Remember, in 1983, the Court of Appeals had specifically noted in the Cayuga claim that it didn't matter how large the claim was, it didn't matter the scope of the potential implications, that simply because the wrong was a grave one did not mean that the federal court could not grant a relief. The Court of Appeals reached the precise opposite result in 2010 in Oneida. According to their analysis, the implications of the decision, even if it were just a money damages award, were so dramatic as to be totally disruptive and impermissible. They would not allow federal law to be applied as federal law literally read. In fact, you can tell a distinction between the 1983 decision and the 2010 decision based on the disrespect that the Court of Appeals gave to Congress in its decision. In the 1983 decision, the Court of Appeals was very careful to defer to the judgment of Congress as expressed in not only the Non-Intercourse Act, but in subsequent federal statutes which had referred to and had assumed the validity of the land claim cases. As is its job, which is to find the law, not to make the law, the Court of Appeals in 1983 deferred to Congress's judgment which had enacted the law. But in 2010, the Court of Appeals reached the opposite result. In 2010, the Court of Appeals, in fact, substituted its own judgment for the judgment of Congress and reached the opposite result. In effect, the Court of Appeals said to the Congress, with all respect, we differ with your conclusion that the tribes should be entitled to assert these claims notwithstanding the passage of time. That is the actual definition of judicial activism, where a court has the audacity to substitute its judgment for the express judgment of Congress that had been repeated in the codified version of the doctrine of discovery, repeated in federal treaties, repeated in statutes that set up a process to identify these claims. In fact, there is language in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals that admits as much, where the Court of Appeals basically says, we don't like the judgment that Congress reached, and we're going to come to a different judgment. I want to read this language to you so that you can understand that the Court of Appeals went much further than finding the law. It actually made the law. The court, let me quote, said as follows, "The Non-Intercourse Act provides that no sale of lands made by any nation or tribe of Indians undertaken without the endorsement of the United States shall be valid. The underlying premise of a claim based upon such a violation is the transaction itself was void ab initio. Such a claim, which necessarily calls into question the validity of the original transfer of the subject lands, and at least potentially by extension, subsequent ownership of those lands by non-Indian parties, effectively asks this court to overturn years of settled land ownership." This the court would not do, despite the clear instructions from Congress that that's what the law provided for. Well, one other point before we reach where we are now, I want to emphasize what the court did not do, even in its 2010 decision. The court accepted its original premise in 1983. That the state of New York had knowingly violated federal law. The court didn't deny that. The court accepted that the transactions had been concluded by coercion and deceit as against the Oneida people. The court didn't dispute that, neither did New York State for that matter. And the court did not deny that the Oneidas had been grossly underpaid for their land. The record is clear, it's documented in the state's own records. It didn't dispute any of these. It didn't dispute, in other words, that a meritorious claim existed under federal Indian law, a claim that fell within the clear language of both the federal statute and the federal treaty. It just held, we will not go there. We will not allow this to take place. At that point, of course, we sought review once again in the Supreme Court. The Oneidas and the United States joining them have filed petitions for certiorari review by the United States Supreme Court. We have made all of the arguments in those petitions for cert that I've summarized before you tonight. That federal law specifically provides for the varied remedy that the Oneidas are asserting. That the Supreme Court specifically affirmed the very remedy that the Court of Appeals denied to us in its 2010 decision, and that the court must review this case to maintain honor with the federal law as set by Congress, which is its prerogative to do, and not as found by the court, which substituted its judgment for Congress. I must say, when I began preparation of these remarks, this is at the point where I thought I would be telling you that the court had denied our petition for review. The petitions were scheduled for a vote by the court this past Monday. Under the rules of the Supreme Court, any petition has to acquire 4 votes to obtain review by the court. That vote takes place, it's what's called a scheduled conference by the court, and each case is docketed so you know when each case is scheduled for that vote. That vote was originally scheduled to take place in the Oneida land claim this past Monday. The following day, the court released a list of cases in which it agreed to hear the claims. The Oneida land claim was not among them. At that point, we feared that we would, within the next few days, obtain an order denying our right to review in the Supreme Court. That didn't happen. Instead, on Monday of this week, we obtained an order from the court indicating that they wanted to have one more discussion about the Oneida land claim petitions. That takes place tomorrow. There will be another conference on the petitions for cert tomorrow, at which place there will likely be a vote, and we will likely know on Tuesday whether we have gotten the four votes necessary to have review in the Supreme Court of the Court of Appeals decision. Obviously, we remain hopeful that the Supreme Court will take the place and hold honor with its prior decisions with the Oneida people and restore what has been a generation of federal Indian law that protects tribal property based upon these fundamental principles of the protective part of the Doctrine of Discovery and the Non-Intercourse Act. We'll find out shortly. Even if the court agrees to take the case, though, that's only the beginning of the battle. The rules require that you have to have four votes for the court to review, but you have to have five votes to prevail. Getting that fifth vote, even assuming the court agrees to review the case, will be difficult. It will be very difficult given the makeup, the composition of the present court. Let me tell you a story about how difficult these cases are. In 1985, when we were in before the Supreme Court the second time in Oneida, we won that case by a 5-4 vote. It's a very close vote. Since that decision was issued, Justice Blackmun, who was one of the justices who vote for us, has passed away. And when that event occurs, oftentimes a justice's private papers become public. We have had the opportunity to review Justice Blackmun's papers and read what he had to say about deliberations in the court about the Oneida land claim in 1985. In the original conference after oral argument to decide the vote on that case, the original vote was 4 for the Oneidas and 5 against. However, the court began to exchange drafts of opinions, which is what they do. That's the next step. There's a minority opinion and a majority opinion. And during that exchange of opinions, Justice Powell changed his mind. Justice Powell switched his vote to the other side. So what had been a 4-5 loss became a 5-4 victory for the Oneidas. These matters are very fragile. They're very difficult to predict. And even if the court takes the case, we can't be assured of victory in the Oneida land claim. So at this point, we don't know yet whether the protective side of that double-edged sword continues to exist. It may be that Indian territory remains only subject to the destructive side, the side where the United States asserts the power to defease Indian rights and to extinguish Indian title at its whim, without giving it the balance of the other side that protects Indian territory against all other comers, states included. We won't know until we hear from the Supreme Court. But let me say this. In a sense, it doesn't matter what happens in the Supreme Court. These land claim cases don't exist because there have been clever lawyers, although we like to think we've been clever enough. These land claim cases don't exist because the federal courthouse doors were opened to them in 1974. These land claim cases exist because of the will and the determination of the leadership of every tribe from the very beginning that experienced this injustice and kept the claims alive by generation after generation after generation, looking for means and justice in any forum possible. That's why the claims exist. Even if the courthouse doors are closed now, those claims will continue to exist. They will exist as long as the history and the culture of those people that gave rise to them in the first place continue to hold on to them and to assert them. And I believe they will. Their leadership has indicated in every instance to this point the determination that regardless of what happens in the federal courthouse, that the claims will continue to exist. We can't say at this point if the Supreme Court does deny review or if the Supreme Court refuses to reverse. We can't say what form redress may take in the future. It may be that eventually the tribal leaders will be able to convince states like New York and others that honor can only be reached by a just resolution of these longstanding claims. It may be that Congress will decide in its judgment to substitute a statutory remedy, it has the authority to do so, that would give the tribes an alternative. We can't say at this point what that redress may be or what form it will take place, but we must have confidence in tribal leadership that they will see a path forward and they will persist as they did long before these cases were first filed 30 years ago. Let me say in closing that it has been the privilege of my career to have represented some segment of the Oneida people in this claim. They have demonstrated a faith in the system, even though it's not theirs. It's a foreign system of law to them. They have demonstrated a cultural persistence that the dominant society could learn from. I can't say at this point what will happen to the claims. We will know soon. I do regret that to this point, there has been no redress available for these claims. But we do continue to believe that whether it's in a federal courthouse or elsewhere, that at some point there will be redress because the Oneida people themselves will insist upon it. Thank you very much.